Hi, I'm Dr. Christopher Newman. I'm Professor of Space Law and Policy at the University of Northumbria in Newcastle in the United Kingdom. I'm also International Space Law Advisor for Cold Star Technologies. I listen to the Cold Star Project.
This show is for entertainment purposes only and is not what is termed professional advice. The Cold Star Project is proudly presented by the Operational Excellence Society. Cold Star Tech is a supporter of the OPEX Society, and Jason Kanigan is a member of its Board of Advisors. Talk with us at Cold Star Tech to find out what we can achieve together with your Lean Six Sigma or Operational Excellence programs. And check out opexsociety.org to learn more.
I'd also like to remind you to check out the America's Future series, the non-political speaker series on U.S. national security and space and defense. Great discussions. Cold Star Tech is a promotional partner of the America's Future series and vice versa. You can check out their website at americas-fs.org. Dr. Michelle Hanlon is our guest this time on the Cold Star Project. We're returning to the subject of space law. The groundwork for that, at least on my foundational knowledge, was really laid out very well by folks like Christopher Johnson a couple of years ago. And we have a really powerful playlist on that topic here on the Cold Star Project, especially if you go to YouTube and look at the video version. You can find that Space Law and Policy playlist. So I've been wanting to have Michelle on for a very long time, but I didn't know what to talk to her about because I covered the basics. And so it's been a couple years since we've talked about space law, and I thought, hey, this would be a great time to have Dr. Hanlon on to talk about updates and changes in space law, things that have happened in the last 2 or 3 years. And I'll tell you, I came away with renewed excitement for space law, and especially an understanding of the Artemis Accords that I did not have before Michelle shared her perspective with me. So Michelle's focus is to responsibly promote commercial space ventures and support our sustainable transition into a multiplanetary species, which I can fully get behind. She's teaching air and space law at the University of Mississippi. She is the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Space Law and has been president of the National Space Society. So Michelle, your very valuable perspective is here. Welcome.
All right, Michelle. So I wanted to have you on for years, but I kind of got full of space law and there didn't seem to be anything topical that was going by. And then recently I was like, oh, there's Michelle again. We definitely have stuff to talk about because there's been a time period in between. So let's start. Thank you for being here. Let's start with give me the 2-minute version of how you got to be who you are.
So I was actually an M&A attorney, mergers and acquisitions attorney by training and by profession. I was 25 years working on basically cross-border mergers. And my sons turned out to be engineers. Both my husband and I are sort of confuzzled by that, but there they are. And they reignited my love for space. I'm a Star Trek baby. And when my youngest went to school, I was like, you know what? I'm going to go back. There's an LLM in air and space law. Who knew? How exciting. So much fun. And we literally left my husband alone and empty nested. I went back and got my degree, my advanced law degree in space law. And I haven't looked back. It's been so much fun.
Excellent. Excellent. And you're teaching as well?
I am. I teach at the University of Mississippi. We have one of only 3 air and space law centers in the world. And we're delighted to have both an advanced degree program. We also have a JD concentration. We are the only ABA accredited school in the world to have an air and space law program. And it's been really fun because in the 5 years that I've been at Mississippi, we've grown the program from just 2 students, LLM students, to about 40. Wow. And so that's, okay. Of course, that's a testament to my marketing skill, but no, right. Actually, it's a testament to the fact that space law is really growing.
Yep. So all you budding space lawyers out there, take heed.
Yes, absolutely.
And she'll send you on to admissions. We'll see. All right. Well, that's great. Let's talk about space. So I got a great foundation from folks like Chris Johnson back in the day of just the 1960s stuff, right? And then going forward. And that seemed to be a really good look at the relationship between governments and property in space and other governments, right? And how are we going to maneuver around? And it was a small playground, not many players, right? It was very expensive. And now we're moving towards a more easily accessible space market where private companies are getting up into it. In your opinion, in the last couple of years, what are the major changes, advancements, improvements in space law have there been?
So we've had an amazing couple of years since 2020 when the Artemis Accords were announced. Mm-hmm. Things have just been flying. And so, excuse me, you mentioned that the traditional treaties, the Outer Space Treaties, really focused on sovereign rights and sovereign right. governments. And we have this one Article 6, which says, well, each country has to authorize and supervise the activities of its nationals. And that's the only way sort of that those laws reach commercial entities. One thing that the Outer Space Treaty has left open, there's that Article 2, which says that a state party cannot claim territory in space by sovereignty or by any other means. So there's been a lot of question about what does that mean? You know, does that mean you can't grab a rock from the moon and bring it back and keep it? Does it mean you just can't put your flag on the moon and claim it? And so the United States sort of which is the largest or has the most sort of expansive commercial program and has the most companies looking at perhaps lunar mining, asteroid mining, said, you know what, we are going to draw the line in the sand. We're going to tell the world that we interpret Article 2 to mean that if you mine it, if you extract the resource, you can use it however you want, you can sell it. And so this was signed into law by President Obama in 2015. And then it kind of fell silent. And we all know deep space industries, planetary resources kind of died and nobody really thought about it. And then in 2019, 2020, it sort of was reborn. And that's where we had President Trump issue an executive order, which said, hey, that moon agreement thing, that one that says that maybe space resources are the common heritage of humankind, whatever that means, that we know, you know, that we're not buying into that. We don't see space as a global commons. We will never sign the moon agreement. And then his administration with Administrator Bridenstine issued the Artemis Accords. And the Artemis Accords state right up front, you know, this, if you mine it, you own it, you know, if you, and not only that, it says, we've got to think about how we're going to we're not going to call it property, but how we're going to interact with each other on places like the moon, where we're all going to the same place. We're all going to the South Pole and we're going to have, you know, sort of rovers right next to each other. So how are we going to manage that? And so the Artemis Accords are really great because, again, the United States just put it out there. This is what we think. This is how we interpret it. Join us or not. And now we know we have 27 signatories of the Artemis Accords versus 18 signatories of the Moon Agreement. So we have sort of this whole new branch of how we interpret. And that's been sort of throwing the gauntlet down. And I'm going to, the idea that this is how we're going to interpret, what's really, really interesting about that is that although China and the Soviet Union, of course, immediately said, well, this is ridiculous, it's imperialist, you know, so forth and so on, they haven't said it's wrong. They just said it's done the wrong way. Mm. So we're really reaching a turning point in recognizing that, hey, we're really going to start doing this and we better figure out how.
Okay. And especially with the moon. Well, thank you for explaining that, because I don't think I've heard about the Artemis Accords in that fashion, right? With that evolutionary sort of approach applied to it. It just sort of came out as like, hey, we all had an agreement. And there was a fuss about it for a while, and then people stopped caring. So I think that's very valuable to everyone listening. That's a thing, you know, now.
Yeah.
How that thought process has come along. And I think it is interesting about how you pointed out that our geopolitical opponents did not say it was wrong totally, right? Just the wrong approach, i.e. they weren't consulted or they weren't involved or it wasn't their process or something like that. Because the moment you have two competing approaches like that, it's going to lead to conflict as people, you know, get to the moon. And even you didn't own the property, you'd put a station up, or you'd put like a tube up or something, that a habitat, right? And it's there, it's on top of the land. You're going to do something with the land. You're not just going to go there and look at it and leave. So
Absolutely. And when you think about it, it's really, you know, China needs to use the resources on the moon with their lunar research station, you know, then the big competitor to the Artemis Accords. I mean, the fact is, if we want to access any part of space, we're going to need to use the resources of space. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of ridiculous to think, oh, no, if you extract resources, you have to share the benefits with the entire world. And I have two issues with that. First, when we look at space in general, when we think about that shared benefits clause, everything we do in space, you have to share. Well, think about it. When the first things that were put in space were satellites, right? Military spy satellites. There was no benefit to maybe keeping peace, right? But that turned into remote sensing satellites. Mm-hmm. So everybody in the world benefits from space. Absolutely. We get our weather from space. We have GPS. And so when we think about resource utilization, there are going to be benefits that we can't even think of yet. And so to say, oh, well, you should have to share whatever, you know, that doesn't make sense. And I don't think when you look at China's approach, again, they've never said, oh, well, that's wrong. You shouldn't be able to extract the resources, because they're going to need to do that, too. Mm-hmm. It's just common sense.
Right. Yep. They're going to need that fuel from the ice.
Exactly.
Okay. So the realism of it doesn't seem to match up to the original law. We're kind of trying to find a new way without actually having become operators yet in the location, right? And so the unexpected is going to happen up there as people get together from different, you know, national sources and start conflicting.
And I love the Outer Space Treaty. I think it's a brilliant document, but it has so many internal conflicts. Mm-hmm. And we just, you know, I feel like back in the 60s, they held the world together and we're not going to put WMD or nuclear weapons mm-hmm. in space. And now it's our turn to actually advance that law and you know, erase some of the conflicts within there. Mm-hmm. So you know, you talk about a base, right? Liability. You know, if you want to go over to the Chinese base, you can't just roll over it and knock it over and stop their operations, right? Because you would be liable, right? But there's also a provision that says, you know, if you have a base, you have to let people go through it. You know, you have to let them approach it. Hmm. And again, if you have a base there, and as you said, because when we go, we're going to stay, that's kind of claiming territory, right? Which is a violation of Article 2. And so what we have in the Artemis Accords is this very sort of convoluted, we're calling them safety zones, but they're really notification and coordination zones. And, you know, we're just going to be considerate of each other. And that wonderful provision of the Outer Space Treaty, due regard. We are going to have due regard for what everybody else does. And the Artemis Accords really try to tease out what that might mean. And that's where we get this concept of safety zones. But the fact of the matter is, Jason, there's going to be property and ownership in space. The UN Declaration of Human Rights says everybody has a right to own property. And I don't think I become less human because I happen to be in space.
Yeah. Oh. I kind of chugged there for a minute. I saw the camera pause. But okay. Well, good. A disaster averted. You know what I was thinking, though? Like, it's so easy to get around these things, due regard and that, and approaching. If you don't care about the diplomatic relations, just put a quarantine period on entering our base, right? Like, how hard is it? It's not hard to come up with administrative reasons to slow things down and impede progress and that kind of thing, right? So, which brings me to something, and I'm curious about your opinion on this, because that's, you know, there's no law on it or whatever, like there is, but the observation of what other people are doing and enforcement on that, there's no space cops. Nobody's going to fly up to you and pull you over and issue you a ticket or something like that, right? So what can we do that has any teeth as far as enforcement goes?
So this is a really interesting question because, you know, one of my hats is the president and co-founder of For All Moonkind, and we want to protect historic sites in space. And you're right, what do we do if somebody goes and pulls the plaque off the eagle and comes down and sells it on eBay? You know, we can try and do stuff after the fact once the artifacts return to Earth, but there's really nothing we can do. So one of the things we came up with was, well, maybe we say if you violate this rule, then nobody will launch you. So of course, all of this requires international coordination, right? Which is something we're not so good at right at right. this point in time. But it's the, you know, when you look at public international law, and space law is essentially public international law, that's a big issue with that. I mean, Russia invaded the Ukraine. That's against the law. What are we doing to enforce that law? Not a whole lot. China created the, you know, the 9-dash line. That's a violation of international law, but, you know, we're still kind of dancing around that. I mean, you know, the U.S. sends its Navy through there. But it's a really important question, and not just in terms of enforcing the law, but also protecting our infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things, you know, when you think about where's the law going, what are we worried about today? One of the biggest issues I think we need to worry about is the dual use aspects of satellites. Every single satellite, every civilian satellite has a military purpose also, or a military capability, or can support the military. And so then what is the DOD's role, the U.S. Defense Department's role, to protect that critical infrastructure if it's threatened?
Yeah, at the very least by flying into something else or denying an orbit to somebody else at the most clumsy, clunky level. Interesting.
Blinding with a laser, you know, yeah. I mean, don't even get started on the cyber aspects of it. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm. which America is very, very good at.
That's
something I learned a little bit more about that Chinese spy balloon and the fallout from that, about how much information the United States actually got from following that thing. I hadn't been aware of that. So, okay. So if somebody behaves badly, maybe we could apply a scarlet letter to them and try and shame them out of. I think there's always going to be somebody, though, who needs the money, and they'll be like, all right, I'll launch you, you know, from Uzbekistan or something like that. Right? I don't
know. Yeah,
that's pretty tough. I would love to see it. It would be great for humanity. But then people would be complaining about a social credit kind of score in that field, too. Right. Of, oh, you're just. You're just blocking them because they're not part of your old boys group or something like that. So.
I think it's really interesting because here on Earth, we have these sort of political machinations and these mm-hmm. paradigms, and we've created this whole sovereign system based on the Treaty of Westphalia. And it's mm-hmm. Very much on tenterhooks all the time. But when we get to space, we don't even have that. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to be really interesting to think about, you know, when Elon Musk first started Starlink. Do you remember this? Mm-hmm. And he had his contract, and it said, if you receive Starlink services on Earth, the laws of California apply. Mm-hmm. If you receive Starlink services on Mars, then you recognize that the no Earth-based law applies. Mm-hmm. And everyone was like, oh, he can't do that. That's wrong. And well, of course he can. He did it. You know, right. How he enforces it is a completely different issue. But I think this is something I have a lot of very dear friends who are, you know, dedicated, brilliant public international lawyers. And I'm like, we got to see beyond that, because mm-hmm. this is going to change everything and yeah. the way we think. We cannot apply that same sort of traditional, studious, you know, wag your finger, name and shame mm-hmm. aspect to space activities.
So what I'm hearing, Michelle, there's a lot of thought about escalation here. When do you escalate? How do you escalate? How much does it cost, right? What's the cost benefit of sending ATF and IRS agents from the United States to Mars to investigate and collect, right? It could become useful at a point, but for now it's ridiculous, right? So, not going to war yeah. just because, right? It's what is worth going to war over? Technically, we could escalate on some of these things, but why?
Yeah, I like that term, and I think you're right. I think that it's really about escalation. Like, what are we? At what point do we escalate? Like, how much mm-hmm. do we take before? And that's, you know, that's an age-old question. You know, how far will you let somebody get to your border before you mm-hmm. sort of send up warning signals? At what point do you, you know, pull the jets and do flybys of that aircraft carrier that's in the sea to a little bit too close? Mm-hmm. And that's really tricky with space, especially with satellites. I mean, we've already seen situations where the Russians have been accused of following our satellites mm-hmm. or French satellites around orbit. At what point do you turn around and say, shoo?
Something, right? Yeah. Oh, boy. there's just so many thoughts in my head right now. So we've got military with sort of standard operating procedures, right? They've got their rules of engagement about how to escalate and when. And then there's the unusual, unexpected situations, which is what I expect would go to the executive, right? They would be thinking about this. What does this mean for the average citizen on the street? Like, how much do we have any control, any power, any influence over any of this stuff? Or is it just, well, let's hope we elect somebody good to the White House, for example, at gamble.
That's exactly it. But it's the voter, and we, you know, the American voter has a tremendously large voice in space compared to other countries, mm-hmm. right? And so one of the things that we're really focused on is raising that awareness. People will say, I don't care about space, I'm worried about putting food on the table. Well, you know, you can't pull your money out of the ATM if you don't have space. Yeah. You know, we have to worry about that critical infrastructure. And, you know, who cares if China gets to the moon first? Well, we have to care, because look at what China has done in the South China Seas. We don't know how China's, I don't know if you have Chinese listeners. I'm not suggesting, you know, that the U.S. might not do the same thing or something, but we do have to create that international agreement where no nation sort of takes control. But we do in the United States. We do have a vote. And one of the things that I really, the space debris issue, mm-hmm. There's no law that says you have to clean up after yourself. There's no incentive to clean up after yourself. And there ought to be. There ought to be a law. And so we should be having citizens on the street. You know, we saw it with Black Lives Matter, you know, or a clean orbit matters. Mm. And we really need to get more people understanding how important space is. Even if you never want to go to space, the fact is people are going to go, and that is going to change our society. Mm-hmm.
Right. And we don't want to be hearing about launch disasters killing civilians because something got in the way that didn't have to be there. Okay. And, you know, I was around for this discussion, folks like Dr. Mora Bajaj, who have been talking about this stuff and trying to sound the alarm for years. I remember when he was ridiculed for it. Mm-hmm. Right. And it probably took 2 or 3 years in the time that I was personally involved. Like, let's not even count the years before
that
when I showed up and noticed his existence, because Fred Kennedy told me about him and said, you need to go talk to this guy. To get it to come around to become a popular idea. And that is my biggest worry about space, is the concept of fashion. Right. The fashion of the moment. People are fickle. they are self-interested. And so there's this constant marketing job that I feel it needs to be done on presenting these ideas to people and saying, look, you know, this is how we tie it in so that you care. And it's a rough go, because I think there's a lot of people who think food comes from the store. They don't think about farms. They don't think about agribusiness, which satellites are doing. They're monitoring fields, yep. And you know, caribou migrations of all things. My brother is in the Northwest Territories in Canada. He's an assistant deputy minister right now, and that was one of his things. He got some NASA satellite time to monitor caribou migrations. Anything up there, whatever you do, you're going to be involved in native stuff, Inuit stuff, and ecological stuff. It just seems to come part and parcel with it. And we talked about this a little bit. So this stuff is important, folks. While it's not maybe in your face every day, it is a part of your existence and how things that you like get to you, right? A ship traveling from a manufacturing facility in China coming to the United States and offloading is using a system or two, right, of space in order to figure out where it is and how to get there. I do a lot of World War II and World War I naval history study, and those guys didn't have satellites.
Yeah.
They had to poke around in the dark, essentially, and try and find each other with airplanes and radio and hope, and just maybe fly back, right, to tell them, hey, it's over there. And whoever found the enemy first was able to unleash that killer blow, right? And now we don't have to worry about such things. We've got satellite pictures of it. So, okay. So what needs to happen with the Artemis Accords for them to come back into the spotlight and get some more energy, I guess. And what do we evolve to from that? Does there need to be some actual operator mishmash conflict on the moon, right? Do we need to get into action?
So there's so many things that need to happen for it to be safe and peaceful and for us to coexist peacefully. One of the things that I think is really interesting is I kind of love that we're back in a race. Artemis versus the International Lunar Research Station, I think they're calling it, you know. And people are like, oh, pshaw, it's not a race. It is a race. I mean, it is a race. And it's very different from the Apollo race because you brought up marketing. Mm-hmm. You know, Wernher von Braun partnered with Walt Disney mm-hmm. to create TV shows about going to the moon. And we came out of World War II and entered into this era where we just thought we could do anything. Mm-hmm. And so going to the moon wasn't like, oh, wow, this is hard. This is just like, of course we're going to do this. And now it's really interesting because it's a sort of, you know, it's so hard to generate this return to the moon interest, which I think is fascinating because if you look at China, they have a lot of public interest or they have generated a lot of public interest. It is front and I mean, I think I wouldn't be surprised if Xi Jinping mentions space every time he speaks. You know, our president needs to do that. Our president needs to remind people how important space is. Mm-hmm. But as far as where do we need to go with the Artemis Accords? You know, one thing that's happening is the, again, a lot of people don't realize, you know, there's a United Nations, an entire committee devoted to the peaceful uses of outer space. The acronym is UNCOPOWIS. There's an entire office, an Office of Outer Space Affairs, which tracks all of this stuff. But the UNCOPOWIS, because of the U.S. decision just to throw the gauntlet down and say, okay, Artemis Accords, this is, you know, the international community is moving too slowly. That actually spurred the United Nations to create a working group on space resource utilization. And I kind of giggle because the remit of the group, it's 5 years. The remit is to identify the legal issues related to space resource utilization. And I'm like, oh, come on. You know, we have so many journal articles that do that, you know, 5 years. But this is how the international process works. And it is important when you have, you know, more than 100 nations now involved in the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space to get everybody on the same page and understanding what is meant by that. Now, of course, it's really difficult because this particular working group has not been able to reach consensus on anything yet, all the way down to where are they going to host their first conference? Okay, the group cannot agree on that. And when I first heard that, I thought, well, that's ridiculous. Come on. You know, how hard is it to decide where to hold the meeting? Mm-hmm.
People and have trouble picking what to have for dinner in groups.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Yeah. But then you get in there and Luxembourg and Belgium want to host this because Luxembourg has this deep, as deep as you can possibly have tradition of hosting conferences on asteroid resource utilization, right? And they want to hold it in the fall because that's when they have the conference and you'll get all of the commercial entities there. Well, the developing nations are saying, no, we can't send another delegation to Western Europe in the fall. We're already sending 3 delegations to Vienna in March and February, March and June. That's too much money. And so then you realize, wow, this is actually a difficult issue to solve, right? Because you have Luxembourg, which already is attracting all of the commercial entities, but you have the developing nations that can't afford to get there. I don't know what the answer is. So
sounds like the subsidizing and shuffling of some money.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to have to be.
Or the operators need to help. It is interesting because we've got, and just to step outside, kind of go meta for a second for our listeners and viewers, because they might not be familiar with this. There's different levels of operation, right? I did a lot of, back in my hometown, I did a lot of committees of council work in the city that I grew up in. So that's municipal, right? And so we have taxpayers, residents, right? We have business owners, we have that municipal government, and then there's provincial and federal government on top of that, right? And state and federal here in the US, right? And so similarly, there is an operator level, there's a state level, there's a federal level, and then there's a United Nations level, and there are probably other levels as well, right? And senior bodies. that are working together here at different layers to solve these problems. Identify. Half the time, you don't even know what you're trying to solve, yeah. Right? Just defining things is a victory. So for the folks listening and watching, what teeth does the United Nations have, and what role are they taking on in coming at this from that senior body level? I mean, folks, there was a guy named Dag Hammarskjöld who was the second UN Secretary General. And if he had lived, his plane was shot down probably by a missile over the Congo in 60 or 61. And that, and it's one of the great mysteries. Now, this was a United Nations Secretary General who poked his nose into world affairs. Okay. Very different personality and sort of process of being the Secretary General than what we've had over the last, you know, several decades, right? And I wonder what the UN would be like if he had lived and his culture, basically, right, had persisted in creating nosy Secretary Generals, right? So what is the UN doing regarding space, and how are they applying that senior layer of authority?
So what's great about it is the way space is sort of growing at national levels, it's also growing. There's a growing recognition at the international level that space is important to everything we do. Now, the United Nations has something called the Sustainable Development Goals, and it's these 17 goals, you know, end poverty, end famine. You know, they're very aspirational, but bring the, and as you said, you know, it's not governing the world, but trying to bring the world together to accomplish things that will help all of humanity. And that's what the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space does. It brings all these nations into the room together. So even at the height of the Cold War, even after Russia invaded the Ukraine, all these countries are in the room together and talking about this stuff. And I cannot overestimate the importance of that, being in the same room, even if you are turning your back on each other. And you know, a lot of nations take the opportunity to decry the invasion of the Ukraine, and Russia gets very mad and says, this isn't the right place to talk about the Ukraine. Why are we talking about it? But even after that, and even if we don't get anything done, we can't decide where to have this conference, right? Everyone's in the same room together talking. And, you know, and we remember that we're humans, and, you know, the person you're yelling at, and Russia, so For All Mankind is a permanent observer to the committee. And so we are, you know, honored to be able to attend all the meetings. And we sit right behind Russia, which is so intimidating, I have to be honest. Because they're just, you know, they're very stoic. And but then you go out and you see them talking and laughing with people from the United States, you know, and that allows us to relate together as humans. And that's why I say this sovereign paradigm, I think, has to go away. Because, you know, China, Russia, you know, I don't know, certainly patriots, absolutely. But there are other ways to relate each other without looking at the borders where we were raised or born.
Right. Which are, yes, artificial lines on a map. And as anybody who has been up high enough has seen, that you can't see them from space. Right. Right. So, okay. Let's switch it up for a second here. And I don't know, we haven't covered this before, so I don't know if you have an answer to this question, but we had ChatGPT come out and AI models and that. And I've got my own beliefs that, though I don't think they're as great as people think they are. But in terms of like if you're a paralegal, this stuff is pretty powerful, right? This stuff could take your job away, right? Doing research and correlation and that kind of thing. Is there any impact yet that you're seeing on space law by AI in terms of like checking out previous documentation, faster decision making, reporting, that kind of thing?
The only thing I've personally have seen is the attempts at blue booking and sourcing, and they're not very good. You know, okay. The ChatGPT, just what they're really good at. I had a student who wrote a journal article as if it was as if she was writing in 2050 or 2080. Okay. And so she used ChatGPT to make up sources. and it is really good at that, you know.
It's hallucinating all the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
I asked it about myself, and apparently I'm the author of some sales books that I've never written. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And I do have sales books, but not these. So
I mean, it's gonna be really powerful, and I think very necessary for space. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things that we're gonna have to do in space that are very routine and basic, and it's gonna be better to have a machine do them. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think there's this sort of fear, and it was interesting. I was reading about, the culture and what we want to be in space. And, you know, there's a lot of ethicists out there who are really concerned about words like colony and colonialism. And, but when you fundamentally get down to what is that community, I'm going to use the word community, although I also have had people say, well, that sounds like a commune. So I don't know what word to use, Jason, but there we go. I use community, you know. So the fact of the matter is we've reached this point on Earth where we have been able to harness technology and sort of differentiate enough so that we have incredible artists, right? We have people who all they need to do is write a song. That's like their role. I don't think we can send somebody to Mars in that first community just to write songs, you know? So the importance of AI is going to be to take up those roles that humans do so that we can continue to expand our culture through art and songs and so forth. And I mean, I don't appreciate art at all. I mean, I love walking through, especially the free museums in Washington, D.C., and I feel like I'm enriching myself. But I couldn't tell you, like, you know, if you showed me a fake Monet, I'd be like, I don't know, it looks real. I understand the importance of it and how that expression is, I think, vital. And there's some, even though I can't personally recognize a quality of a masterpiece, I see the beauty in even in pieces on the street. You know, it's just that expression is so wonderful. And it always makes me think back to the first way humans communicated, right? Drawing on walls. This is an expression of our humanity. And so I think AI hopefully will be able to help us free up time for that expression as we move forward.
Right. You got me thinking about Banksy graffiti on the outside of some Martian habitat.
Exactly. No, you know, and I, when I talk about Apollo and protecting the heritage sites, you know what we humans do all the time? Is we want people to know we were there, like in the Vesuvius in I'm blanking on the name that Pompeii. They found graffiti that literally says, you know, Jack was here, you know, way back when. That is something so human. And you look at the Apollo astronauts, and Charlie Duke left a picture of himself, and, you know, did Neil Armstrong leave his daughter's bracelet or not? You know, we have somebody shanking a golf ball. That's like, what is more, I was here than I hit a golf ball on the moon. It's such a human thing to just be like, no, remember me, I did this.
What are we going to have to do? Encase it all in plastic or something? Like, yeah. a big amber blob of it. You know,
it is really interesting because there are companies that are part of their funding plan is that they send stuff to you to the moon for you. Mm-hmm. So, Charlie Duke left a picture of his family on the moon. I could send a picture of my family to the moon. But, you know, as lawyers, we think, okay, that sounds great now, but what happens 100 years from now if everybody on Earth decides to send a picture to the moon? And you have 7 billion pictures on the moon. But then I'm like, well, Charlie Duke got to do it, so why shouldn't I be able to do it? Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's just a lot of interesting, even these really mundane little questions, I think, in space law are fascinating, but then I'm a space law geek, so. Right.
We could have all these cities of the dead for photographs of people on the moon.
Exactly.
Slide open your little drawer and see that from Uncle So-and-so. Oh, weird.
Yeah, exactly.
Very interesting. You mentioned in our notes a couple of things about like the United Arab Emirates and Luxembourg and that, and also space resource utilization, some sort of agreement on that. Let's talk about those.
So this is, again, one of the things that the U.S. has done is the U.S. has always been a leader in space and in space law as well. And so we are the strictest on our people. We have the most sort of robust regulations for launch, for the environment, for human exploration. And, you know, we are also the first nation in the world to actually have an act which recognizes that there are artifacts in space and says you can't go too close to the Apollo lunar landing sites because we don't want you to destroy them. So when President Obama signed the Asteroid Mining Act, in the United States, we believe that if you extract a resource, then you can own it and you can sell it. That was just like that blew up the world, the space law world, right? I mean, for us, it was just like, oh my God, wow, really? You know, and you had really. I'm going to call them the global communists, mm-hmm. And the commercial industry sort of at odds with each other. No, that can't be right, because if you get something, you have to share the benefits. And the commercial industry saying, well, no, you know, if I'm going to invest billions of dollars, I ought to be able to extract that investment. And so that caused quite a consternation, you know, and one of the big things, of course, when the Outer Space Treaty was signed, 2 years later, the United States brought back moon rocks, and nobody said, oh, you don't own them, right? They didn't say, oh, you have to share them with everybody. The U.S. did share them with a lot of people. But so we have some precedent there to say, okay, clearly, if you extract a resource and you use it for scientific purposes, it's fine. But the United States took it one step further and said, no, but you can sell it if you want. And then Luxembourg said, yeah, we agree. We're going to pass a law that says if you, and it's not just if you're Luxembourgish, the United States law says if you're a U.S. citizen, this is what the Luxembourg law says. If you're licensed in Luxembourg, you don't have to be Luxembourgish, okay. Then we will support that you can buy and sell whatever you want, the resources. UAE followed shortly after, and then most recently Japan. So what we're seeing, again, when we think about public international law, and a lot of people decry the fact that, oh, we're not passing any binding laws in space. We haven't since before the Moon Agreement. So we do have to look at a national level and get more and more sort of this custom building among nations. And so when we say Luxembourg, Japan, UAE, the United States have laws that say if you mine it, you own it, that's starting to build a custom. What I have not seen any country say, oh, no, if you are from Ghana and you go and extract resources, you can't keep them or sell them. I mean, who's going to say that now? So we've created a custom, in essence, that says, yeah, okay, we recognize that if you extract the resources, you can sell them and do what you want with them.
Okay. I kind of like this for two reasons. One, it's not just U.S. centric, which I know I tend to get bogged down in, right? It's very easy to be here, right? And I want to hear stuff, voices from outside. The other thing is, too, it's not like it's the haves and the have-nots. Right. And the haves are like, yes, exploit. Right. And the have nots are like, no, you got to be communist and share it with us. Right. It hasn't come down like that. There are global commons type folks like you're mentioning. And I get where they're coming from. But it hasn't, nobody's put forward a law, is what you're saying.
Right. And when we think about the term global commons, right, it's not really a legal term. I mean, what does that, I think we have, we could have a conversation about what that means, but there's no ICJ rule that says a global commons means this and this and this and that, right? And in the Moon Agreement, we have the common heritage of humankind. Again, what does that mean? There's no legal definition. And so when I put the global commonists into, this category over here, it's much more, oh, these are the people who are wanting to work harder to make sure that these benefits are shared. Mm-hmm. And they terrify industry because industry doesn't want to, you know, needs to make a return on their investment. And so it's, I'm going to be completely honest. I'm right there with industry. I think if you're going to spend $1 billion, then you ought to be able to extract it. But again, because I see the benefits coming in different ways, benefit doesn't mean I get a piece of the cash. there's so many other benefits that we can't even imagine that will come from it.
Right, right. Space pollution. Do we care? Is there such a thing? I mean, if they're producing something, manufacturing something, there's got to be a byproduct, right? Is there any law about where this goes or what's to be done with it or how other people are to be kept safe from it?
No, not at all. I mean, the only law we have is that liability. If you do harm, so it's interesting because if you do harm, if your space object does harm to Earth or something in flight, then you have absolute liability, right? There's no, doesn't matter. You can't say, oh, it wasn't my fault. I hit a bird, whatever. Absolute liability. You do that damage, you know, you get hit with that Chinese rocket, you can sue China under the liability convention and they owe you. In space, it's a negligence standard. Please let me be the first attorney to go to space and do due diligence on on what happened to a particular satellite or something. But when you think about pollution on orbit, is orbit considered part of the Earth's environment? All of our environmental laws are very Earth-centric. We're going to protect the Earth's environment. We're going to protect marine life. We don't talk about, because what is there to protect in space? You know, we can't. You know, there's no oxygen, but there is a question of whether orbital debris should be considered environmental pollution. So that's one way to start thinking about it. What I find fascinating is that nobody official is making that claim. So when 2 years ago, China sent a note verbal to the United Nations, and Article 5 of the Outer Space Treaty says astronauts are envoys of all humankind. And if you see something that is potentially harmful to a human in space, if there's a phenomenon, then you have to notify the world through the United Nations. So China sent a note verbal in December and said, 2021, and said, hey, United Nations, there's a phenomenon in space that is dangerous to humans in space, namely our taikonauts. And do you know what that phenomenon was? It was Starlink. So Tiangong had to maneuver to avoid Starlink satellites twice in the fall of 2021. What was really interesting, so just for the record, the United States responded and said, hey, China, you know, we were tracking, you really didn't have to move. And in the future, instead of calling, you know, the school principal, why don't you just call us? You know, here's our phone number, essentially. But what was really interesting to me is they used Article 5, right? They used sort of that phenomenon hurting humans in space. That was a perfect opportunity to use due regard. Right? You're not showing due regard. But I don't think any nation wants to go down the due regard path because, wow, talk about opening Pandora's box.
Because now, yeah, the same lens gets used on you.
Exactly.
Okay. I can see like output of poison gases or, you know, or anytime we're going to mine asteroids, there's going to be waste, right? There's going to be rocks flying around from that. They're not chunks too. They're more like bodies that are gravitationally pulled together. And even if they go into jolts or cells, honeybee thing or something like that and get heated up and processed, there's still going to be stuff left over floating around somewhere, right? And how fast is that going and where does it go is an issue.
Michelle? Even on the moon, the plume effect, right? You know, if you land on the moon.
Who do you want to meet? Who do you want to talk to if they're listening or watching and you'd be like, hey, they should reach out to me?
Elon Musk.
Really? Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I doubt he's watching my show, but who knows?
You never know. Yeah. Right. No, I think because he has the power of a nation right now and he is the new paradigm. And you know, as much as people decry what he does and now he's so fickle and that was a bad idea, you know, he can do that. And I think it's really fascinating. And I think he has Gwynne Shotwell, but I think he could use another good space lawyer.
Okay. Well, we can never have too many.
That's right. That's a fact.
All right. Yeah. Michelle, well, you've personally changed my mind and expanded my thinking today, particularly about Artemis. And but putting it in its location, in the flow of the evolution of ideas, right? And the shifts in government policy and that kind of thing as different administrations come and go. So thank you very much for that. I appreciate you doing this. If people do want to reach out and contact you, what's the best way? Like LinkedIn?
LinkedIn would be perfect. Yep. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for doing this.
Jason, thank you so much. It was really fun. I enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you, Michelle, for that great perspective on a wide variety of space law topics. Again, it got me excited in looking at this stuff again. So thank you very much. If you are a space or defense founder and you have a pet project that is languishing and it's just not moving ahead, nobody is really available or capable of picking up the pieces and moving the ball down the field, you should be talking to us at Cold Star Tech. This is a thing that we do, short-term project management. It doesn't saddle you with a full-time employee. It gets a highly skilled person in there to pick up the pieces and run the ball down the field and get the job done. And that might be 6 months, that might be a year, but then the project's over and you're not stuck with this person forever on your payroll, all right? And most importantly, this thing gets done. I have seen out there in the world folks saying, oh, that's not my job, or I've already got enough on my plate. And if that's the case with your people, it may not mean that there's anything wrong with them. They just may be full, you know. It might be time to talk to us at Cold Star Tech. Just go to coldstartech.com or message me on LinkedIn, and we'll take it from there. This is Jason Ganigan, the founder of Cold Star Technologies and the host of the Cold Star Project. Thanks for listening.